Blog Talk Radio.
Chicago's Black Business Network exists to assist you, the individual business owner, in your efforts to reach the next level of service and growth. We have some powerful resources in Chicago. Open the door to opportunity at chicagosblackbusinessnetwork.com. Enter. There is no charge. At chicagosblackbusinessnetwork.com, we are here to network. Are you? Join us today and touch the world. Hundreds of members are waiting to connect. Chicago's Black Business Network is dedicated to the legacy of the late Mayor Harold Washington. Let us not forget his service to the city of Chicago.
Innocent people like you and me get caught in the middle of it.
Well, what's wrong with them?
Baby, I don't know. They need change in their lives.
I'm a man of peace of mind.
Welcome to Chicago's BlackBusinessNetwork.com on Blog Talk Radio for Tuesday, December 8th, 2009. This is your host, Sonia Perdue. CBBN on Blog Talk Radio is a promotional tool for the members of Chicago's BlackBusinessNetwork.com. Currently, our organization has more than 500 members, and this is where our members come to share information about their products and their services with you, the Blog Talk Radio audience, and the world. After the opening announcement, you were listening to Common Ground, performed by Kosha. Kosha is one of Chicago's very own vocal artists. In 2008, Kosha signed with Emblazon Entertainment. The CEO of Emblazon Entertainment, Hakima Muhammad, is a member of CBBN, and you may contact her on our website to book Kosha or other up-and-coming Chicago stars. You will find them at www.emblazonentertainment.biz. That's E-M-B-L-A-Z-O-N, entertainment.biz. We've also posted the information on our Blog Talk page, so you can pick up the information there. Love that song. That is a great song, and she has some other great hits, and we're going to play those in some upcoming shows. This week on CBBN on Blog Talk Radio, we ask the question, have we lost our minds? This show is entitled State of Emergency, the Mind of the Community. Because more so than ever, members of our community are reaching out for help and not finding it. The mental health issues facing our people have left all of us vulnerable and under attack from within our own ranks and even from within our own homes. Join us as mental health specialists conduct a roundtable on the current state of emergency, the mind of the community. Have we lost our minds? We're going to have various people join us this evening from different areas of the mental health field. Therefore, their perspectives will be different. I have never worked in the mental health field or in the medical field. I've done a lot of things, but medical was one of the things I did not hit. So I'm going to play the role of the layman, which I am really, with no experience in the field, and I'm going to ask, as they join us, I'm going to ask them a question, and let's see what's on the minds of those who serve our mentally ill friends and relatives across the nation, because we all have friends, and some of us ourselves, and relatives who are in need of counseling and assistance. Like all of you, we always ask the question, will I know when I've gone nuts? And I would like to know, how do you tell? How do you ask yourself that question? Am I crazy or am I still within that huge, huge range called normal? But before we do that, let's do a few announcements and a little bit of housekeeping. Our caller number is 347-326-9477. Our caller number is 347-326-9477. The chat room is open. Leave your company information and website links in the chat room. Press the number 1 if you would like to speak to one of our guests or if you have a comment. Now, if you're listening to us on the Internet, you may want to switch to a media player. It's my understanding that it sounds better than coming directly through the Blog Talk Radio website. So that's another choice for you. You can hear us live at blogtalkradio.com/CBBN. blogtalkradio.com/CBBN. And as we said, this is where our members come to share information about their products and services with you. We're a business organization. We have people from all over the country. We are a Chicago-based organization, and it's an advantage for us because we get to go out and meet and greet each other, have coffee, lunch, dinner, go to each other's events. So that's a great advantage of being part of Chicago's BlackBusinessNetwork.com. But we want all of our members to have an opportunity to showcase what it is that they do. That's why this show was set up for them to use as a marketing tool. This is a list of just a few of Chicago's BlackBusinessNetwork.com members who have been a guest on CBBN on Blog Talk Radio, who joined us right here this year, and we want you to come on and promote your products also. In April of this year, Lionel Pittman of Pittman's Plumbing joined our show. Now, plumbing doesn't sound exciting to you, but that was a good show. It talked about a lot of things as far as contracting, like contractors, the number of plumbers who are licensed and certified in the state of Illinois was so low that it was amazing. He joined our show in April. Latrice Fowler of Raising Young Chefs. Her book should be out now, but that was a great show. In May, Roots and Shoots joined us. They're our very own organic farmers, Mr. and Mrs. Gillespie, very well versed on what they're doing. June of this year, Weddings by Naida, who is an event planner, was with us. Also, Carl Erickson, inventor of King's Battlefield, the game set that you've seen featured on our main page. You should also see it featured now on our Blog Talk page in the Amazon ad box. That's King's Battlefield. In September of this year, Tori Muhammad, founder of Being Soup Times, co-hosted a show with me, and that was great. State Representative Constance Howard called in on that show. Also, Wendy Muhammad, otherwise known as the Authenticity Coach, the world's leading expert on authenticity, was with us in September. Now, if you want to know what authenticity is, if you want to know about finding your true self, you need to listen to that show. You know that all of our shows are in archives. And we want to thank you for the hits that we're getting on our archive shows. We really appreciate it. I'm not quite sure where they're all coming from, but it's really great to go in and watch those numbers go up. October this year, Kenya Renee, writer and producer of The Cycle, joined us. That play was held in October, and it was great over there at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. We want to thank Kenya Renee for all that she did. November, Bobby Johnson, Third Ward Committeeman in Chicago, joined us. The first, Mrs. Muhammad Ali, was on the line with her that evening. Ron Carter was there that night, chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago. Also in November, Mama Edie Armstrong, professional storyteller, joined us. And on that show with her that evening, Mr. Robert Earl Lewis, owner of All for Kids Enterprises, was with us. He's the publisher of children books. So we've had an exciting year. We've just started this year. And I tell my people, it doesn't matter. Start now. It doesn't matter what you do. You can do it. And we want you to come over and be a part of CBBN and be a part of our show. This is what we do. We connect and we network. Join us and touch the world. Hundreds of members are waiting. This show and our website are both dedicated to Mayor Harold Washington. Everybody on our website knows this. Anyone who's listened to our show knows this. It is our way of giving respect to his memory and all that he did for the people of the city of Chicago. He was our mayor from 1983 until his death in 1987. CBBN is dedicated to keeping his name up front and on the minds of the people of the city. So each week we like to share something about Harold with our listening audience. Now, according to one bio, in 1942, Washington was drafted into the U.S. Army and sent overseas as a part of a segregated unit of the Air Force Engineers, then part of the U.S. Army. Washington served 3 years in the South Pacific and rose to the rank of first sergeant. But what this bio does not say about Harold Washington is that during his military term, Mr. Washington took more than 100 correspondence courses. This is part of the reason that he was so well-versed in so many areas. It wasn't the university education. Yes, he got the law degree. He did that over at Northwestern, but that wasn't the only thing. It wasn't his only life experience. He exposed himself to so many different subjects, and although he was in the midst of madness, the military, he fed his mind other foods and thoughts so that when he completed his military training, he walked away with more than just some discharge papers and memories of the military. He walked away prepared for life. That is the Harold Washington that you saw. Every time I think about him taking those courses or hear about Malcolm X studying the dictionary during his prison term, it makes me pick up a of what I normally read and study. I don't do a lot of fiction. almost everything I do is nonfiction. I read a book the past couple of weeks. I just need to get my mind off of what I was doing, but I rarely read fiction. But all that brings me to another point. I've shared this information on the show with you before, and I want to share it again. We need to pass this type of information forward. We're passing so much garbage around and gossip, and that may well be a part of life, or some lives, but in between that, we need to share some information that will actually enhance the lives of other people. And we're going to go to our phones and go to our guests, but we want to get all the housekeeping done, because I tell you why, we get into our shows, our callers get into the shows, and it's gone. I mean, the 2 hours, I've never seen 2 hours go so fast, which I'm excited about, I'm happy about, but I've learned that I'm going to get the housekeeping in first. I want to get this information out because I think it's important, and I hope that you do too, and I hope you can do something with it. This is what I want to share with you. The International Commission on Workforce Development. Now, when I say those words, you probably turn it away. You don't want to hear that. International Commission on Workforce Development. You don't even know what it is. They provide access to over 1,500 state-of-the-art and certification-level courses for free to end users online. I'm going to repeat that for you. The International Commission on Workforce Development provides access to over 1,500 state-of-the-art and certification-level courses for free to end users through the sponsorships by individuals, the sponsorship of corporations, foundations, and government agencies. It's already paid for. When you go to the site, you'll see eSkills 360, and that's how it's referred to on their website. It's an e-learning platform that equips girls and boys, women and men, with 21st century employable skills so that they are ready to compete in the global economy. 1,500 courses, people. The resulting well-trained individuals attract multinational and local corporations to invest in their local economy by providing a talented workforce for their company. Companies want to hire skilled employees. That's what they're saying to you. And what they're saying to you, here's 1,500 state-of-the-art courses. Get yourself skilled. Now, if you and your whole family can learn start learning all these new skills, what you think will happen? Let's suppose that you and a few of your family members got together and picked out a course, just one course, and then each week had a discussion of how things was going with that one course. Can you imagine what would start taking place in your family? And then maybe in your block club or maybe in your organization? These are free courses, 1,500 state-of-the-art and certification-level courses for free. When they say certification-level courses, they mean technology, and it's right there on that website. That's www.icwfd.org. If you look on our show page, you'll find the link under Workforce Development. You'll see a link, Workforce Development. You can go right in there right now and start. I just put a shortcut on my desktop so that I can be reminded to take some courses this winter. Just passing it on, people, just passing it on. We want to thank all of you for joining us. We want to thank Jacqueline Robertson, founder of Dreaming First, for joining us last week on CBBM. Ms. Robertson is known as the Dream Sister, and it was an honor to have her on our show. Our calling number is 347-326-9477. Our calling number is 347-326-9477. The chat room is open. Press the number 1 if you'd like to speak to our guests or if you have a comment. Stay tuned for tonight's show, State of Emergency, The Mind of the Community. Have we lost our minds? We're going to the phone lines right after this. You're listening to CBBN on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Sonia Perdue. Stay with us, please.
Hello, my name is Jacqueline Robertson. But they don't call me that. They call me the Dream Sister, and let me tell you why. Because I know that the entire secret to every aspect of life has to do with dreaming. If one doesn't have a bigger dream, bigger than the nightmare that they're currently experiencing in their life, then that nightmare is the dream that they're going to have to take with them. in my life, I had some serious challenges and deficits to overcome. A hearing and a speech impairment at an early age. The loss of both of my parents at the age of 17. Then after 21 years of marriage, losing my spouse abruptly to cancer. And thereafter, my only son receiving a near-fatal gunshot wound to the head. And most recently, a long, tragic, chronic 4-year divorce where I was at risk of losing everything that I had possibly worked for up until this point in life. Regardless of those things that occurred in my life, I had a bigger dream. And that's the point that I drive home in my presentation, that regardless of where you are in life, your present or past conditions or the cards that you feel that life has inappropriately dealt you, you can begin to live your dreams. It's your inborn, innate right to dream and go anywhere you want in this universe. The key is to know who and where you are and what known roles to take to make those dreams that you hold deep within yourself become realization in your life. My presentations and workshops and seminars are those known roles. My topics include my signature speech, Dream It First, how to manifest that dream into your life, dream attitude, how to deal with life's unexpected changes and challenges once that dream is manifested in order to stay on track with that dream. Then finally, the secrets of success and happiness, which is basically the secrets of service and how serving others with the spiritual seed of reciprocity that you can begin to live your dreams. My objective in life is to share the raw maps that I know that will lead to growth and exciting process of growth. You never, never, never stop dreaming.
You're listening to CBBN on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Sonia Perdue. I want to thank you for joining us this evening. Our subject this evening is the mind of the community, state of emergency. Have we lost our minds? We have a couple of our guests on the line right now, and we're going to bring them on. And let's introduce our first guest here. Lynn McDaniels, you're on the line. How are you this evening?
Fine, thank you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to CBDN, Blog Talk Radio.
Glad to have you, Lynn. Lynn, tell our listening audience a little bit about you, and then I'm going to bring Abina on, and we're going to start our session. We're expecting a couple of other people, but they're coming in at different times. So tell us about Lynn McDaniel and McDaniel Consulting.
Okay. My name is Lynn McDaniel, and I have a Bachelor of Arts from DePaul University and a Master of Arts from the Adler School of Professional Psychology. I got into psychology because, of course, people that get into the social service industry, they're always concerned about people, and as a child, I was always interested in why people did things, why people said things, and why they acted a certain way. I've used my degree at the Community Mental Health Council, which is under the prestigious umbrella of Dr. Carl Bell, the Black psychiatrist. He is the psychiatrist to the Black Stars. If you remember when R. Kelly was going through his situation, he was the psychiatrist for R. Kelly. He's also been the psychiatrist for the radio personality Crazy Howard McGee when he had his situation with domestic violence with his girlfriend and numerous other stars. I think that in the Black community, we do not discuss mental health enough. It's always pushed back into a closet, even if you watch the television show or the movie, Soul Food. Remember the uncle that never really was a part of the family. He always sat on the robe, and he was always pushed back in the background. They would bring him his food. He was not allowed to participate with the family. Well, hopefully tonight someone will call in and we'll be able to have a dialogue on the importance of communication and, talking about mental health, mental illness, and that ugly stigma. It's the same thing that if you break your leg, you go to the doctor and you get a cast so it can heal. It's the same thing with the brain. If there is something broken, thank God in this, thank goodness in this day and age, we do have medication that we can use. We do have therapists that we can go to. We do have exercise plans that we can adhere to, as well as good habits such as going to bed at the same time every night, getting your straight eight, as we like to say in the industry. No distractions, no radio, no television. All sorts of things to help build up your brain. For example, not if you're right-handed, try using your left hand a little bit. If you're left-handed, try using your right hand. For example, when you're coming home, whether it's by bus or by car or walking, try to take different routes. That way that makes the brain strong. There are a lot of little tricks that you can do. Mental health is a very interesting phenomenon, and I've seen a lot of different things, and I've seen some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful success stories, and I've seen some horrific failures. And so, and there you have it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lynn. Now tell me this, Lynn. Did you tell me that you went to graduate school with your daughter? Did you all go at the same time?
Yes, we went at the same time. That was the agreement. I was a single parent. I sent my daughter to school on the North Shore. I felt that the only way that we could get out of this financial cul-de-sac is that if we got an education. Education was stressed in my life as a child, and it would be automatic that I was stressed to her. So she said, the agreement was once she started college, we would start together. I started at DePaul. She started at Knox College down in Galesburg, the site of the Stephen Douglas debates. She graduated, and then she went to Loyola to do the first leg of her graduate work. I went to the Adler School. She decided to go to an African-American university and HBCU, and she got accepted at Howard to do her PhD, and she finished her education degree at Loyola and went to Howard and received her PhD. When she finished at Loyola, I was at the Adler School, and we both had our degrees, and that was the plan, and it worked out just fine. And she says, come on, Mama, let's go. I'm getting my PhD. And I said, no, that's enough. That's enough for me. You go. So now my daughter is a professor at Kent State, a professor, a doctor of sociology, and she has a book that has just hit the market October 29th called Black Woman's Burden. It is really about the sexual commodification and the reproduction of the black woman. And they talk about the different aspects. While it's all right for John and Kate plus eight to have eight children and six at one time, or it's okay for Octomom to have the children in abundance, it's not okay for black women to have those children. The majority of black women are sterilized before they even leave the hospital. And I know that we're talking about mental health, but I just wanted to say this because this mentally, I'm going to air some dirty laundry. When I had my daughter in 19, whatever, I was not asked if how I wanted to feed my child. Did I want to breastfeed? What was the plan? No communication. They automatically gave me a shot, and I didn't have any insight or any communication with that aspect. I was very young, but still no one communicated to me. So that's interesting how this whole, how they look at black women from slave time back in the day as a commodity because they were made to birth children to put into the slave industry. So it's really an interesting book, and she's already a finalist for the most prestigious award in sociology. And actually, she's up for two. Book has already gone into its second printing, and it just came out a couple months ago, so I'm very pleased.
Of course you are. Of course you are. And I have Ms. McDaniel to say these things to our listening audience, and I'm going to put it on our CBBN 1-Minute Update, because and talking about mental health, and we're going to bring Abina on in a minute, and talking about mental health, we need to talk about some successes. I think our children, our people, we, me, you, we need to hear the language of success. I told Ms. McDaniel, if I had been growing up, I didn't know about the Fulbright, what's the Fulbright scholarship? What did she get?
The Fulbright Rhodes Scholar. I mean, my daughter had an opportunity in undergrad, not even grad school, in undergrad, to go and live in Europe for 1 year. She lived in Europe for a year, and she lived all over Europe, and that was through a scholarship to Antioch down in Yellow Springs, Ohio. They were a partner with her Knox College. And another thing, in graduate school, and she was at an HBCU, Howard University sent her to Brazil to live for 1 year, full stipend, full money, full education. She went to, she attended school there, developed friends, a whole lifestyle, and she was able to tell me how different parts of Brazil reminded her of different parts of Chicago. It's the same all over the world. We're all over the world, everybody. We're one. We're all one. But that was a wonderful opportunity for her. She's had many wonderful opportunities, and the opportunities are still coming. She's going to take a two-year hiatus from Kent, and she's going to go and she's going to film in Africa and the Ivory Coast, South Africa, and I can't remember the other place, but she's going to film African women and their struggles and their trials and tribulations and do documentaries. So hopefully we'll be seeing that in the future.
That'll be wonderful. And, you know, I say these to Ms. McDaniel so that we can listen to the language of success, so we can hear these terms, so we can hear the terms Howard University, so we can hear tenor, she on tenor track, or she's teaching, she's a doctor, these scholarships, this travel. All these things need to be a part of our language. We have so many things in our language, and that's psychotic as well. It's causing us to have psychosis, the language that we speak and what we hear all the time and what we're talking about. But I wanted her to say that, and I'm going to have her come back and say it again, because we need to hear it and we need to repeat it to our children. Well, you know, you can go down there to Howard and do that, or you might be able to go over to Europe, or you can go to Africa and go to school, or you can go to London and go to school, or you can go anywhere you want and go to school, okay, because the money's there.
It's very important for everyone to know. Well, first of all, I'm going to break this myth. There's a myth that our children do not go to school. It is also a myth that African-Americans do not get an education. Well, I don't represent all African-Americans or education, but my girlfriend's children went to college. My girlfriend's children graduated and went on and became professionals in my circle of friends. And I have a very large circle of friends. And their children, I have a girlfriend that when her daughter was in Latin school, in high school, she was invited into this program, and she could choose what she wanted to do, and she decided that she wanted to learn how to fly a helicopter in high school, and there was a program that offered her, how to actual going to Midway, getting, not Midway, what is that, Lakesville, getting into a private helicopter and learning how to fly over Lake Michigan. So don't say that our children are not educated. Our children, America, our black children are educated. Our black children do go far. We do graduate. So I want to just break that myth, number one. And number two, the higher you go in school, folks, people, the higher you go in school, the more opportunities come your way. All of that travel. I had another girlfriend that went to, where did she go? She went to Pakistan for 2 years. She went on a teaching ship, and it would dock everywhere, and then it stayed, and she stayed there for 2 years teaching, and then she came back. My next-door neighbor, she's University of Chicago, a little black girl from Georgia. So these things do happen, and they're not rare. It's just that the media and society would like to believe that we do not go far and we're not educated and we don't want to be educated, and in fact, we do. It's about getting the right information. We have to be aggressive in getting that information. If we do not get our information and start looking for it and digging for it, Nobody's going to give it to us because we're not privileged like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it is out there. The money's there, and they can do it. Abina, we're going to bring you on the air. How are you this evening? Thank you for your patience. I think it's working now. Let me try it again. Abina, are you there?
Yes, it's Abina, and I'm here.
Abina.
Yes.
I get it right.
That was okay.
Abina. Okay. How are you this evening? You doing great?
I'm well.
I'm glad that you took the time to join us. Tell our listening audience about what it is that you do.
Well, where would I start? I work currently in the arena of substance abuse, drug and alcohol, as a drug and alcohol therapist, a counselor. I have a bachelor's degree in mental health technology. I have a master's degree in social services, it's clinical social work, and all but dissertation in couple and family therapy. So greetings to is it Linda? Lynn.
Lynn McDaniel. And greetings to you, your ABT. Greetings to you, all praise. Greetings. Very
good. Yeah. So I've been listening. So that's what I do currently. I've worked in this behavior health field, mental health, behavior health field for about 25 years or so now. Before going into the field in terms of going to school for it, I was a consumer of services, if you will. Started my journey into the arena of helping people in this way by first recognizing that I had some mental health issues and I needed some help. And so I sought out help. And as a result, wanted to give back in that way. Had always wanted to be in the helping profession. And when I first started out in school back in the late 70s, because I grew up in that era also where education was the key, was said that education was the key for our success in pulling ourselves up, so to speak. I always wanted to go into nursing, and I started off pre-nursing. I started off at, Rapid Change State is considered a HBCU. It was a state college back then. It is now a university. But I started out at a HBCU, Cheney State University out in Pennsylvania here. And life kind of took me in a different direction, and I stopped school and kind of went through some things, a marriage and a couple other things, a substance addiction myself, kind of recognized I needed some help, went and got some help, regrouped from that, and then got back into school because I'd always been sort of intellectually inclined, if you will. And so I started back to school and didn't stop from there, you know, went on and, like I said, I'm ABD, all but dissertation in the field of couple and family therapists, therapy. So it's interesting to listen, you know, as I listen to you, Lynn, talk about the higher up you go in terms of the opportunities. I think for me, that's not quite the same. I'll say this in my typical formal introduction whenever I speak and do my own facilitate my own meeting, Racism Non-Anonymous meeting. I introduce myself by saying that I am Abina, and I am a recovering African enslaved in America, Kaka, and that I am true to the cause of African liberation via unification and utilizing the tool of healthy and effective communication. And I consider myself, or call myself, a communications coach, as opposed to a therapist, and I found that to be somewhat important for folks of African descent because of the stigma attached to therapy and mental health that we still seem to carry. No one wants to sort of admit or acknowledge that they have some issues, if you will. Yet what I've come to know for sure is that all of those sort of quote-unquote issues stem from relationships and how people relate with each other, how they communicate, with themselves, how and what they communicate with themselves, and how they communicate with other folks. Being a representative from the voices in the margins is a key thing for me, because one thing I know for myself that has me in the position that I am in, which is sort of still being on the direct line. I'm a direct service worker, if you will, on the lowest end of the totem pole in the profession. I work directly with the people. I carry a caseload size of over 30-some-odd folks. I'm not in a supervisory position. I'm not in a director position. I'm not running my own organization, and I don't have my own business, so to speak, at this point. However, I'm certainly qualified from every different, from personal and professional, as well as academic perspective, to be in that position and to not be in the position where I'm sort of on the lowest end of the totem pole. Yet I know for myself, in large part, that's because of being a representative from a voice. I didn't leave out of the margins. I didn't leave the people. I didn't leave my family. And when I say that, I mean that in terms of emotionally as well as physically. I stayed very connected. And as a result, I think for me, you know, I've always worked in the 25 years I've worked for public nonprofit service organizations, working with folks surviving in poverty. And that has sort of kept me here in this sort of position. And it seems that over the course of the past 25 years, people are getting sicker and sicker, if you will. It's certainly what I see. People, many of our people in the margins, on the lowest end, are sort of getting sicker and sicker, despite the fact, if you will, that there's so many opportunities out there. There's many barriers for many people that continue to happen, and I'm clear, you know, coming from a systems perspective, that a lot of it has to do with what's going on the societal level. And in the community, because stuff flows down all day, every day, and so the people who are at the lowest end catch the brunt of it. That is people in my family. Yeah, I was going to say in my family. One thing, it was really nice to hear the way that you and your daughter, Lynn, sort of supported each other. Those kind of supports I didn't have. I was kind of like a trailblazer in my family. The middle child of five children, and the first to finish high school on time, the first to go to college, and nobody else in the family were doing those things. And so, you know, I didn't have those type of supports. Everything that I got, I had to fight for to sort of get. And then when I got to a certain point, people were ill and people needed help and needed support. And so I stayed kind of close to do that. But as a result, it just kind of has kept me down here, if you will.
Let me ask you, and I want to be sure I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Abina?
Abina.
Abina.
Uh-huh.
Abina. Okay.
Abina. Mm-hmm.
And if I do it again, correct me. Abina. I want to thank you for joining
that's
us.
That's a Ghanaian name. Yeah, that's a Ghanaian name. It's a name that I kind of claim for. It's like in my process of recovering my true self, my African cultural self. In the Akan tradition, they have a way of naming children based on the day of the week that you were born. And for children born on a Tuesday, the Bina name is, for a male, it's Kwabena, and for a female, it's Abina. I mean, that's a name that I have taken for myself. It's not the name that my parents gave me. It's not my legal name, if you will. Yet it is my recovered name.
I got you, Abina. Mm-hmm. And we can do that, and we can all do that. And some people probably should change their names. But anyway, Abina. Okay, I've got it. Let me ask you a couple of things. I saw the information that you sent to me. Trauma is at the heart of it. Unresolved trauma. Do you think that we're experiencing trauma? Is that what you think we're doing? What's going on with this?
Yes. Yes, we are, as a people, under constant terror and trauma, constantly. and we had from our through the process of enslavement, active and, you know, passive noun, and like folks say, they've taken the chains off of our hands and wrists, and they have put them on our minds. And as I say, you know, in the recovery room of Racism Not Anonymous, which is a program that I have developed to support our healing, it's what I call a revolutionary 12-step program uniquely designed with the African in mind, and it's designed to support us with healing from the ma'afa, which is the great trauma that we suffered at the hands of Europeans in the West. The first step to that program is first and foremost admitting that we live in a world where white supremacy is the primary ideological belief system, and we have been programmed into that system. And as a result, our African lives have certainly become unmanageable. And my premise, if you will, is based on the fact that we do and have lived under domestic terror. We have been emotionally, psychologically, and culturally and spiritually traumatized, and we are continually terrorized and traumatized. We are not really free to be what we choose to be. We are free to participate in the European system as it is established, and that is the reality. Even for the name of Abana, you know, you have to pay to change your name, and it costs dearly anymore to be able to change your name. When I go to work dressed in traditional clothing as I see fit for myself, then I'm subject to a whole lot of questions, ridicule, comments about, you know, why don't I just be a good American, so to speak. I believe that for me to hold the label of being quote-unquote African-American is to uphold a mental schema of being culturally schizophrenic, because to be African as I know it and have studied it is diametrically opposed to this thing called being American, where everything is based on capitalism, greed, hoarding of resources, and not practicing the principles of Ma'at, which is what I believe is appropriate in terms of African culture and African centeredness.
Let me ask you, Abana, have you had someone in your workplace say that to you? Why don't you dress more American, or why do you dress like that?
Of course, yes, over the years, yes. Certainly, over the years, I've had, you know, and this comes from both folks of European descent and folks of African descent, where, you know, you get these kind of comments. And when I went through my master's program, I went to my master's degree is a master's in social services. So that, you know, for people who are in the social service field, kind of knows that there's only 7 schools that give you an MSS as opposed to an MSW or Masters in Public Health or whatever. Yet it's a very elite school of social work, one of the 7 sister schools. And why did I say that? I said that to say that in that school, one of the things that we did have a dean of African descent and a missions, I think Nancy is a missions person of African descent, and they were very, very conscientious about the unique and needs of African descendants in institutions like that. So when I started, they made sure we were familiar with the National Association of Black Social Workers and that we were connected with that group of folks. And so that every year that I was in my master's program, and it took me 3 years because coming from where I'm from, you know, I had to work and go to school, because by the time I went back to school, I was, you know, a full adult, had been married once and was separated, yet I had to work. I had to work a full-time job and go to school, so I had to take out loans in order to pay for school. But they made sure we were connected, and every year that I was a student, I also went to a NABSW, a National Association of Black Social Work Conference, every year. So while I'm getting the education in the halls of academia and the institution at the conference, I would also learn from many of our scholars of African descent, like Dr. Amos Wilson, Dr. Asa Hilliard. I would hear Maxine Water on the political front, and just all of those scholars, Naeem Akbar, Kanjufo, all of those people where I consider my, you know, also my professional parents, because I also, and so what I learned in school, what I learned while I was working also in that field, was all sort of filtered through this lens of African culture. And so I was learning all of those things at the same time, which is a little different, because if I had gone to a Spelman or a school where there was more African-centered and African-focused, I probably would have had the opportunity to learn more culture in the school setting, yet I was certainly not going to get it at Bryn Mawr. But I did get it going to the conferences. Mm-hmm.
Evan, may I make a comment?
Sure.
You know, I just wanted to say, audience, that I really understand and I really feel everything that she's saying, because when you are, as she stated, not only a middle child, but a child that is coming out of our family, that, you know, you're the first to graduate high school, you're the first to graduate college, and everyone's looking at you, sometimes they're not looking at you, they could care less, and you have to go forward, and then you enter into this education system that is so elite and so private and closed off, and you're just in there, and there's no support for you in there. Luckily, I heard you say that you were with the different societies that, you know, that kept you abreast of what's going on and sort of kind of cradled you through. A lot of children go through high school to college with no support system, no family support system, no education support system, no group support, no real group support, and they drop out because of that support. So that's very important. And one day, Sonia, you might think about doing an education show, because this, you know, this is a different world. Education is a different world, and I think that's why so many people are kind of like, because once you get into that world of education, you know, some people feel safe going to HBCU, but it has its stigmas and it has its pressures there as well. They're different stigmas and pressures, but they have them. And then if you go to an Ivy League school, or if you go to a heavy hitter like UFC, University of Chicago, Loyola, Catholic institutions, or like you said, the schools, the sister schools, the seven NSSs and all that. So that can be very difficult.
Mm-hmm. It can be very difficult. Now, I want to touch on a couple of things that both of you brought up. I'm going to ask a couple of questions. Lynn talked about the culture of success among Black people, and there is a culture of success. I've taught at the collegiate level. Our students, our children do go to college. They pack up every fall and they leave Chicago or maybe Pennsylvania. A lot of them do. They pack up and leave, or they go to the local colleges. A lot of them do. They're gone. They are in school, and then we have a subculture of another kind that has to be recognized, whether you call it trauma, drama, or whatever it is, that are stuck where they are because of stigmatisms about education. Now, let me put this to you. If you look at, because I grew up in the projects too, if you look at the group overall, I know a lot of people out the projects, a lot of my girlfriends went to college out the projects, you know. But then you have this, I guess they want to refer to it now as subculture of people who are totally offended by the idea of people going to college. And what Lynn was saying about the support system, they did not have the support of the community because of envy, jealousy, failure of some to progress in that particular way, to make those choices. I know one of my guests and I had a conversation on some other shows about the fact of the number of grandparents raising their grandchildren. And I think that the number came up to like 16 million nationwide or some number like that. And my question was, well, out of these 16 million grandparents raising children. All these children had two parents. So that's like 32 million people not taking care of their children, that their mamas and daddies are taking care of it. And so he wanted to throw out the same thing about black people being traumatized. Well, you know, the FBI came into the community and sold drugs and all of this happened. I say, well, what about those people on the other side of the street that didn't buy drugs from the FBI and didn't make those choices and didn't leave their kids behind? They were not traumatized by living in that same community. I'm not an excuse person. Wait a minute, let me finish. I understand there's going to be problems, trauma, drama. I understand racism. I'm black. I've been black for 50-something years. But let's come back to what your personal responsibility is also. So my question out there, is there a subculture? It looks like it to me when I walk into Chicago, because there's a subculture of poverty out there, real poverty out there, and a subculture of mental illness just walking the street untreated out there. Abana?
Yeah, I was going to say, because, you know, the definition of trauma, when people are traumatized, trauma, you know, in and of itself is a condition that suggests that the person has insufficient resources to manage whatever the stressor that is coming at them. Those who sort of, if you will, fall victim to substance abuse are likely to be those who had insufficient resources to protect them from that. Those resources come in a variety of forms. And so for those who choose or who have were introduced and then kind of went forward with it, the emotional, whether it's the emotional resources, the community resources, educational resources and support to not end up continuing to rely on that as a way to manage stress. Substance use, and for me, the thing about, yes, drugs and stuff were intentionally pumped into our community. And then the other thing that I know, being an addictions expert, if you will, is people, substances, alcohol and drugs is not the only thing that people use to manage or cope with stressors. People use food, and they're just as addicted to food. They use relationships. They use money, gambling. There are gambling. So many things. And people, you know, work. Yeah, there is this thing called workaholics and workaholism where you spend so much time working that you, emotionally you are not available to your family or the people who are close to you. That in and of itself is an addiction. Some addictions, if you will, are acceptable, just like nicotine is legal. So we don't count that so much as addiction. But they're also pumped in our communities in certain ways. They advertise to our babies cigarettes, but just by the location of the advertisements in certain areas. All of those things are addictive behaviors. Yet, more often than not, people seem to not recognize their own addictions, because when we think addictions, we only think about drugs and alcohol, and it does. I mean, in many ways, because of the detrimental and very visible impact that it has, you know, you could see that. It's kind of hard to see the workaholic and see the emotional damage or the damage or the trauma that that might be creating in the family, but you can certainly see someone who is hooked on crack cocaine and the devastation that that's causing, and it causes it in so many areas that, you know, it just is a bigger picture. My thing
I
is,
understand.
So that's the thing. You know, trauma is certainly somebody who has insufficient resources, and then understanding their resources come in a whole variety of things, and more often than not, you need several tools in order to manage and to protect yourself from those type of things, and people don't have those. So they use what they have, and if that's what they have, that's what they end up using.
I want you to catch your breath. I know. You know, Amina has a talk show on Blog Talk Radio. she can do the show. I want you to catch your breath. Lynn, is there a subculture of undiagnosed mental health out here? And you know, when I walk around the streets of Chicago, it appears to be to me, or am I just paranoid?
No, you're not paranoid. And we're using the term subculture. You know, this is pretty much mainstream. It's the norm. You know, there's been cutbacks and deficits, and they've closed institutions, and they've closed prisons, and they've allowed people to come out untreated with no, you know, now we're changing this whole thing up, fee-for-service, you know, medical cards, and people that are homeless and suffer with mental illness, you know, they're not always, they don't always have an address where they can get a medical card sent to them, and they are not, you think that they're, you know, collecting mail, they're pushing the shopping carts, for God's sake. You know, people are ill, people are sick out here. Gosh, it's so much that I want to say. It's really painful as I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
People go into the system out here, the jail. You know, sometimes, you know, I've had my clients tell me they're throwing a rock through the window so they can get arrested, so they can go into jail because they need a place to stay. Once they get into the system, you know, they'll be treated by a psychiatrist out of Division 5 and get their medication, and they'll be there for a month or two. They'll get through the winter time, and then they'll be released in the summer. So people have been using the prison system as a mental health system. You know, I had a client that, I mean, we've all got a million horror stories, but I first started as a mentally ill, I was a mentally ill substance abuse clinical therapist. And, you know, the 12-step groups, just like Evan and I said, that 12-step group, that mantra, it does really need to be rewritten for black people. I think somebody white wrote that, and I think that it just needs to be tweaked because this is a different time. We're more than just one people, and it needs to be tweaked toward that. The way that they run this 12-step meeting, in my professional opinion, I would prefer it be different. I run my meetings differently. There are a lot of people out here walking around that you ever go into a grocery store or something and somebody pushes you and they look at you and you say, what's wrong with them? You know, a lot of that is mental illness. Mental illness manifests itself in several different ways. And, no, you're not paranoid. There is a lot of mental illness out here. Go ahead.
I want to ask you about that. You brought up that subject. Is it... And I watched some things that was going on since I was putting together this show. Is some of it just, and I don't want to give examples, I really don't. Is some of it poor manners? Is some of it just, as we said, you know your mama raised you better than that. You're supposed to know better on some of the things that they're doing, such as the language and
I feel that there is definitely a difference between mental mm-hmm. illness and bad manners.
Mm-hmm. You think it's
an illness, and you can tell that someone is mentally ill rather than just utilizing bad manners. If someone is if you're in a currency exchange, for example, if somebody comes up behind you and they're standing a little bit too close and they're breathing on you, you turn around and give them the eye, and they step back, you know, they get it. But if you turn around and they get closer to you, they're kind of calling you out in their own way. You know, those little things like that detect a mental illness.
Okay.
You know, and Evan, you can co-sign with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I would say that is a traumatic stress response. You know, when you don't have the ability to protect yourself from, you know, and we as a people, have caught stuff from the society, community, within our families, and we do stuff to ourselves. But if, you know, somebody bumps against you and you get that reaction and you hear or see that reaction in and of itself is a traumatic stress response. So it no longer takes It's like when you've been emotionally and spiritually pounded, force-fed to believe and behave a particular way, it doesn't, all it takes is a little touch to get the same response. You go from 0 to 10, you know, just from a feather touching you as opposed to a hand touching you, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And you know,
response, go ahead.
I said, my husband is in the industry, in the social service industry as well, and he calls what Ebony is describing as the reality show syndrome, where, you know, they, like she said, they go from 0 to 10 in 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm. I got you.
And I see that happening all the time. Sister Sonia, all the time, and a lot of the times, is you're seeing it from people who do not have a diagnosable mental illness, if you will. They have an illness; it's just not been diagnosed. They have not come to the attention. It has not caused problems in certain areas of their lives where it comes to the attention of a behavioral health or mental health professional. That doesn't mean that they're not, you know, having some problems. They're just not telling you. Most of them did not feel
functioning.
They're not going to tell you.
But
they're still functioning. We have been programmed to tell ourselves we're okay. There's nothing wrong. Focus on the positive. Don't focus on the negative. But it's that, and my thing is, it's that negative that's kicking our behinds because we refuse to focus on it. So we kind of keep looking to the left, and or keep looking to the right and getting blindsided constantly by the stuff that's coming at the left. But we are so programmed to, you know, tell ourselves that we're okay, it's okay, God's going to fix it, you know, all I got to do is and then we don't address it. And it just it's an illness that just goes unchecked. We have never been able to prepare ourselves from the effects of slavery.
I wanted to say this before I forget. Like, Ebony, you just said, you know, they're it is there, yet it is undiagnosed. Sonia, there is a book out that we utilize, and we call it the Bible. It's the DSM, and the DSM-4.
Right.
And now there's an addendum to that. And it really needs to be rewritten for people of color. And I'm laughing about it as I think about it because, you know, within the mental health industry, there is, to me, a little bit of racism because I remember all my clients, 99.9% of my clients are always automatically diagnosed schizophrenic, you know, and all of the white clients are always diagnosed bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about you, Evan, on your travels, but that's what has happened to me in my travels.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody cannot have that same diagnosis.
Absolutely.
You know, and like you said, they need to expand these diagnoses because people have all sorts of illnesses, not just paranoid schizophrenic, not just bipolar disorder, not just depression. You know, there are many other ones.
Right,
the system
is highly, you know, it's highly racist, but that's what racist white supremacy is. It is a system that it has infiltrated every single area of our lives, in every area that we function in. Right now in the mental health or behavior, that's why they changed it. It used to be the mental health field. When I started out in it, it was the mental health field, and I would always say emotional health because it's really not about necessarily mental health. It's our emotional health. It's how we deal with our emotions. Addiction, if you will, is the disease of the feelings, and that starts with what we think. What we think about ourselves, or what are the messages that we have been told about ourselves, and what are the messages that we pass down to each other. We start off with our children telling them, you're so bad, and you don't separate the child from the behavior. So the child grows up with the message that I'm bad, and then they begin to learn what is good and what is bad. Well, they already been programmed to believe that they're bad, so then they begin to behave, you know, more. You know, as they fit that label, bad.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about addiction.
Communication. Go ahead.
Abana. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about addiction. Now, in the time that I grew up, we didn't even consider them addictions. Drinking, and we know it was a problem. Smoking.
Yes.
We know it was a problem.
Yes.
But it wasn't considered addiction. it wasn't considered anything bad until they reached the age where they lost a lung or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was totally looked upon as something totally different. It was cool. It was okay. They were swinging, you know.
Right.
But
we
know that these things, it's still legal. We know these things mm-hmm. are devastating to the body and to the family, to the children and everything else that they affect. So now they have this language, and it's all about
language
too. Called soft addictions. So I guess you don't feel like you really blowing up. Soft addictions to the computer, soft addictions to your cell phone, soft addictions to I guess how much you drink. If you're not a heavy drinker, or if you're drinking martinis, maybe it's just a soft addiction. But like Abana said, it's still an addiction. It's still affecting you. I'm gonna give an example of something that happened. This is CBBN on Blog Talk Radio. We're talking to two mental health specialists. We're expecting Keith Vessels. Hopefully, he will come in soon. And he's done a film on mental illness, and talks about how it's misunderstood and undiagnosed. And I think he's almost finished. I saw his trailer on it. So hopefully he will join us shortly. I did speak to him a little while ago. But I saw a young lady on the bus, and she had two little kids with us. They were dressed. They were clean. You know, she was under 20. She had two kids. And she got on the bus, set the children down, and she started talking on her cell phone. So the little boy interrupted us. She said something really nasty and vulgar to him, you know, because she didn't want to be interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So then after she got off the cell phone, she it felt like she was having a relationship with the cell phone. She went through the Rolodex or whatever you call it, the contact.
Mm-hmm.
She rubbed it. She polished it. She moved it over. And I'm sitting there watching her. I said, she's having no relationship with these kids, but she's having a relationship with this cell phone. Am I crazy, or is that a mental? Is this something going on there?
Well, first of all, we don't say the C word.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's right. You know what, Lynn? I have worked most of my professional life to stay away from that, and I would correct people that people are not crazy. I'm coming now here in 2009. It's like, okay, I give up. You just crazy.
What you say? You give up.
The jury is in. It's done. There was a time where we wasn't, but I'm like, it's hard to hold on to it. Maybe that's because I'm sitting down here in the park just watching all this. It's like, okay, we crazy. That's it.
We have to be positive. We have to stand in the positive
way. No, we got to call a spade anymore. You know, I'm a narrative. Go ahead, Chief. What is it? Because I don't know if I even remember anymore.
But wait a minute. That's where self-help comes in, because you always have to take care of yourself every night. You know that when you're in this industry, it's imperative that you, when you're dealing with people that have so much drama and so much madness and so much illness, you always have to step back and take care of yourself. Allow yourself to get caught up. You will be through. You got to take care of yourself. Your own rest. You got to do your own mental health stuff. But in regard to the question that you just asked, Sonia, did you think that it was something wrong with what she was doing in your heart of hearts, in your mind's eye? Did you perceive that as being a little bit out of the ordinary?
And it's not only her. It's not like she was having a relationship with that phone. But I couldn't figure out what was going on with it. I'm like, what is she doing? It's like she loved this phone. But she wasn't communicating with those kids. So I perceived that as being something wrong with her. I'm just saying. I thought it was something wrong.
If you perceive it to be something wrong with her, and she wasn't interacting with her children like she should have been, then perhaps it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know. That's my thought. But
that's the nature of addiction. People have the relationship with whatever it is that is giving them pleasure, that is making them feel good or feel okay in the world. And we use that, and people will use whatever it is that they feel that's making them feel good, that they use it and use it and use it, and they stop having a relationship with people, and they start having a relationship with stuff. whether it's a phone, whether it's a relationship. And even, and then the nature of addiction is, even though you may come to a point where you recognize it's not so helpful and it's taking me away from these other things, I keep doing it anyway. And mm-hmm. it starts to get more and more problematic. She could
you know
make love,
think?
She couldn't give, she couldn't nurture that child in the way that she had the phone. Maybe something wrong with that.
You know, I think if she hadn't been going on and on with that Lynn, it would not have attracted my attention, but it was just
right. Well, if
born.
You felt like it was something going
so.
On, it was something going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can you see it every day. You can go, you can just you know walk around in some of the underserved communities in Chicago or in any state or anywhere in the world. Walk around in an underserved neighborhood, and you're going to see all sorts of signs of mental illness. You know, I saw mental illness as a child growing up. I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, I had an uncle that used to speak in the Cockney accent. I grew up in Inglewood, for God's sake. I grew up it was a mixed community then, but he spoke in a Cockney accent. Hey, mate, how are you, governor? And there was no cause for that, and we would just laugh as children and continue to play. There's our Uncle Clifton, and he's speaking like he's a Cockney police officer in London, England, and we would just kind of laugh it off. You know, but, you know, later on, in later years, we found out that he was addicted to heroin. He was an IV drug user. So, I mean, all sorts of things. You see as children why people... You know, the things that, like you said, weren't acceptable, aren't acceptable now. Domestic violence, there was always the man that used to beat his wife, and then one day she does him all green and she gives him hot grits. I mean, you all this domestic violence, all of this mental illness, all this alcoholism. How many women on my block as a child I remember pregnant and drinking some CC and Pepsi? I mean, how many women in the morning did I see addicted to something as simple as Stand Back? And for all of you all out there that don't know what that is, that is a little powdered aspirin, but back in the day, I'm sure it was more in that packet, the little wax paper packet, because I saw all the neighbors every morning. Would you please go to the store and get me a bottle of, Royal Crown Cola, RC, and in a bottle, and they on the front porch in the morning, instead of having coffee like we are addicted to today, they would drink Royal Crown and Stand Back. So, you know, there have been addictions forever. But one of them, what I remember, this is the main thing that kind of made me say, okay, I've got to do something. I had a nephew that used to lock himself out of the house every day. Every day. And I said, And he would come to me because I had the key, and he says, I need the key to get in. I've locked myself out. And he would lock himself out 3 or 4 times a day. So I said, okay. And he was funny, and he was smart. He was an architect when we were children. He was, you know, we were all the same age, and he's doing heavy-duty architectural stuff, so it wasn't that he was stupid. And let's get something straight out here, people. Because you have a mental illness, that does not mean that you are stupid or less than. Does not mean that at all. And like I said, I have many success stories of some of my clients that could, you know, consume the services that I offered that were, you know, had fantastic careers and money. So, you know, let's get something straight. But I got an opportunity to see firsthand how addiction works. I got a firsthand opportunity to see how mental illness works. That same person, I saw him. I went into his room finally when I had to have him a petition to go to a mental health facility, and I walk into his room and 50 jars of urine in there, a dresser drawer full of cash bills that he'd been hoarding. You know, so I saw all of these to the 10th hour. So, you know, I think that I was lucky in a lemon to lemonade sort of way to actually see how these things happen, how they transgress, and the outcome today. Well, today he's fine. I mean, you know, he's taking his medication, he's exercising, he's practicing good mental health. He's cool. Family, car, house in the suburbs. He's doing all the things that he needs to do for himself.
Let me ask the question. It seems as time goes on, and we were just talking about this a little bit
This is CBBN on Blog Talk Radio, and we're with our mental health specialist today, and we're talking about a number of things. And as time goes on, how we perceive correct and incorrect behavior, you know, I'm a layman here, changes. So how confusing is that to us today as we look at things? You know, in my age group, when we say that's deviant behavior, and I'm not sure if this is the right language, but they said, no, this is just normal, acceptable behavior. How do we distinguish that? I mean, is it, if it's harmful, and then how do we, harmful to who? How do we determine this? It may be something that we perceive as sexually deviant, and it might not be to another whole generation of people, or how does deviant behavior change? It seems like it's being redefined. Some things are acceptable. It's acceptable to pop a pill in the morning if you're depressed. That's not an addiction, even if it's prescribed, you know. How do we define deviant behavior? What makes a person mentally ill? And maybe not even that far. How do we define that?
I would just say it's like you said, and you said something earlier, it's about the language. I know it could be a game in terms of the games that Europeans predominantly play, because we do live in a system, I'm clear, of white supremacy, where their ideological beliefs and how they do things is the standard that everybody else must follow and ascribe to. And they do have this thing called the language game. And that's all they have to do is begin to language it. And I guess then you may remember, in the original DSM, probably the first DSM and maybe the DSM-1, homosexuality was considered a mental illness. And I believe it was a diagnosable mental illness. Well, when they came out with the two or the three, somebody decided, okay, well, we're no longer going to label this or language this as a mental illness, and we're going to language it as such. And so then they just begin to rewrite it. And it's just the same way they've done with everything else in this country and globally. They rewrite history when they get ready to. And that is how we know what is acceptable and what is not, what is deviant and what is not, because somebody tells us and they begin to propagate it. They begin to disseminate it in all of the areas that they have for disseminating information through the media, through movies, through school, educational system, through programs, even mental health, behavioral health, you know, programs, and they begin to disseminate this information. They begin to bombard you with the information that tells you, oh, okay, this is now okay. When 50 years ago, it was seen as a problem or it wasn't okay, and then they change. You know, Nellie Fuller teaches us that one of the primary tools that white supremacists use is words. They use words to confuse, and it is extremely confusing if, you know, 10 years ago, it wasn't acceptable to get up in the morning and take a pill. Now it's okay. Say I work in the hospitals with children, predominantly children of African descent. At the age of 5, 6, 7, they are hospitalized in a mental health psychiatric unit. Little child, this child must have been about 7, and she was having, you know, a normal little temper tantrum. They wanted her to do something, clean her room or something, and she didn't want to. And so she began to have a temper tantrum, and there was the white nurse. And this is a child that's like 6 or 7. Here, take this pill. It'll make you feel better. And the little girl's like, no, I don't want it. Because children know when they take those pills and those medications, they don't feel very well. They get very sluggish. A lot of my consumers do not want the medication. All these different medications they're coming out with are designed. They're not helpful. They hurt. They do more harm than good. The kids, they want to take the pill. But the only thing, the only resource that this nurse seems to have available to her to address this 7-year-old child was to try to convince her to take this pill. And the more she tried to convince her to take the pill, of course, the more that then it got into a power struggle, the more the child didn't want to take it. I did intervene, and I just began to talk to the little girl in a seven-year-old language and begin to reason with her. Well, look, if you don't clean up your room, they're going to make you take the pill. So do you want the pill? No. Okay, well, then what do you might want to clean up the room? And then the girl started cleaning up the room and doing whatever it was that they wanted her to do. But it didn't take much to just begin to look at the child, reason with the child, and talk in a different kind of voice. But they are been socializing our children to take pills, where now it's pretty normal to get up and take my medication. And then you wonder why 20 years later you have all these folks who are hooked on substances. Hooked on now.
Let me ask you.
Pills is the primary addiction that many people have, and they are legal and they are prescribed. They're classified as non-narcotic. However, the way they behave in the body is just like any other narcotic. And physiologically, you will get, your body will become dependent on it.
Let me ask you a question. Mr. Vessels is on the line. I'm going to go to the line. Okay, you perceive this as being part of her racist makeup. Is it a part of her training? Is it easier for her to do her job if she just gives all of these people this pill so they can shut up for the day? I mean, is it? I mean, like, you know, I'm not going to say it's not.
You know what? This is
a little bit of all of those things. Yeah. Go ahead, man. I think it's a little bit of all of those things. Yes.
This is a very difficult line, because because I'm pro medication. But I understand what Evan is saying, because I have seen the abuse of the medication from the doctors and the nurses. I've seen it. How are you going to give somebody five different medications and they're all of a sudden they were just a regular weight, then all of a sudden the next month they've blown up to an obese size and they're drooling and, that's over-medication. But I also have seen the promise of medication when it is used correctly. Luckily, I was able to work in a facility that was run, like I said, Dr. Carl Bell, and an African-American psychiatrist, and the house psychiatrist, Dr. Blunt, African-American young man. And it was wonderful to have that, because I was allowed to come into the actual office whenever they had an appointment to sit with them, and where they could not communicate what was going on with them, because I'm working with them as a clinician, I was able to communicate it. Right? And you know what? Sometimes you have to kind of step in. If they get too much medication, you look at their medication when you do medication monitoring, and you say, well, you know what? You don't have to take this every day. How do you feel? I will deny it, but sometimes they take too much medication, and sometimes all that medication really is not necessary. And it is a way for them to tweak it, but they have to have the wherewithal to know that and to work and try to tweak it to make it right for them.
And most people don't know how to do that.
And I'll say this, and I know you have your guests, but I just want to say that I have, like I said, when I started out as a consumer, and I did use medication. I did take antidepressants, so I know the benefits of it when it's used appropriately. And I know the class of medications that they have coming out now are very different than what they had out 30 years ago. However, I do recognize the benefits of it when it's used appropriately, and when it's designed, when it's helpful. But there's a whole different class of medications now than what they had out 30 years ago.
Or when the pharmaceutical reps are just, they're pushing it, and the doctors are getting their payoffs, and the consumers are taking all this medication, and they're just sitting there with this pill box full of medicine, and they're just eating it like it's M&M candy. I am totally against that. I'm totally against that, but I have seen it work wonders.
Okay. Ladies, we're going to go to the phone lines. This is CBBN on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Sonia Perdue. We're going to go to the phone line. Mr. Vessel, how are you?
How are you?
I'm doing great. We're going on here. We're into it. Abana is here with us, and Lynn McDaniel, both of them are healthcare specialists. Kevin D. Vessels is a talented filmmaker from Denver who has created a documentary movie that explores the plight of millions who are afflicted or labeled as mentally ill. So tell us about you, Mr. Vessels, and about our projects. We're all ears.
Okay, I started producing about 4 years ago. I got the idea to produce a television show, a movie on mental illness in this country. And from that, I teamed up with another filmmaker, and they've traveled around the country for about a year filming and producing this show dealing with mental illness. Actually, I first got started with it because I was working with a program called Face It. It was developed for a young man who was killed in Colorado named Paul Childs. And he was a handicapped individual as well as having mental illness. The program was actually designed to team up with the police department and the community for people who were mentally ill who would call in, and instead of tying up police time, they would go to Face It, the Face It Project, and we would try to give them kinds of assistance that they needed. And I was working on the committee, and I realized that maybe what was happening in that situation and other situations is that there was something was going on in this country with mental illness. And so I developed a thesis that this was not just an isolated case, but all over this country, there are people who are calling in that need assistance and are not getting it. And it's from that I started to team up with another individual, and she decided to just sell her home and travel around the country for a year filming all over this country about mental illness, the good and the bad programs, what's going on, how people are reacting. There's such a gray area in this country about, you know, if you have someone who's mentally ill, what do you do with them? I mean, how can you give them the help that they need? And some laws are where they may need the help, but the family can't give them the help. And if they need the help, they can't find the proper programs. So there were so many variables to filming that we just filmed it all. And the film, it tells the story about what's going on in America.
So, and the name of it is Combo Number 3, Madness in America. How did
right.
you come up with that? Combo Number 3? What is that referencing?
Well, Combo, it was actually named The Call for Help, and we changed it. Combo 3 has to deal with a poem that's written inside of the film when it begins, one of the psychiatric patients that the person is filming found, they actually wrote that poem, so that's where it actually comes from. But the original name of the film was A Call for Help. We had to change it because of there is such, when she got out on the road, she realized that there was more going on, you know, than just a call for help. There's a call for, you know, just everything in this country. So there's actually madness in America. So that's why they changed it.
Okay.
But it definitely deals with, you know, when we started this, each year something has been going on. We're getting to the point now we're getting to the point now where systems in this country are, budgets are being cut, and the first people to be cut are the mental health programs. And, you know, it's going to be a problem when people come back from the war, because there are many soldiers that are going to come back and over time overload the mental health system, which is so fragile right now. So we really need a really good discussion. And I was thinking about when you were talking about, just earlier, when you were talking about how the children and that kind of thing were being over-medicated, sometimes we have to look not only to why we're giving the medication, but what are the causes of this? Sometimes the causes can be something as minor. You know, some situations might be where people who are in the community can assist people who are in need and they don't need medication. Or it may be that person may be like in some of the different alternative medicines where they take the kids and they're taking, they remove red food dyes and colors out of their systems where they're not being, you know, reacting to stuff in their environment. So sometimes it's so much easier for people to just give somebody a medication to find out, well, why is this going on? I mean, when I first started my film, it was like, well, why is that individual calling the police 51 times? Why did they not get the kind of help that they need? And that's what we need to really think. We need to think beyond just the box of, well, let's give them medication, but find out where it is. And in fact, you'll find a lot of times these people may do better if they get the kind of assistance they need than to wait until they're in a situation where, like for instance in our film, they go down to the hospitals and are loading up the emergency rooms, and the fees are enormous for those emergency rooms because they're not getting the assistance that they need as they're going, you know, as they're in the community.
Let me ask you, do you think that the system is just overwhelmed with it? If we just start tracking from the Vietnam War, the mental illness, which is not discussed as it should be, that's there and still there now, 35, 40 years later, these people are still here. They still need treatment. They still, you know, required. And then there's been a couple of other wars. And then we've got this culture of prison, people coming out of prison. We've
right.
got a culture of people being homeless. We got this underlying, which part of that, not all of them, are disabled mentally. And can't get back into a system normally. Maybe they didn't come into the homeless system like that, but and some of them, as from being part of that system, have, you know, been afflicted with different things and they can't come up out of it. So now we're moving into those things, and then the alcoholism, the crack of the 80s, we're moving through that, and then now we've got another war, as you say. They're going to move through the system. Is the system just overwhelmed?
I think the system needs to be revisited and figure out, there needs to be a coming together of so many entities to figure out what needs to be done for different situations.
Mm-hmm.
That the system is so overloaded that there's several things they can do, but we need to start talking altogether about what can be done. And there's another factor there too, and that is there's a stigma in this country about mental illness. People do not want to address the fact. They just, you know, they just don't want to deal with people who sometimes are mentally ill. And the other thing is that we look so much at the people who are mentally ill that are the severe cases. There's a lot of people that aren't severe. They go to work every day. They just have a few issues that need to be worked out. And we don't look to see that. We only see maybe the homeless people or those kinds of things. So there's that problem. Now, there's a whole other problem in the financing of a mental illness, and that is the insurances. Lower copay, you know, the copays are higher, less office visits. So a lot of these people end up wanting to get services but don't have the amount of money to do that, so they overload the systems of the hospital. The hospital's systems are starting to shut down because they can't take all the mentally ill patients. So they're closing a lot of your beds in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So what is happening now is a lot of people are diverted from prisons, going to prison because they have to get them off the street, and the families may have said, we need help, but there's nobody to really help them. So it is a problem that is so complex that it's a matter of, in this country, we're going to have to bring everybody together and say, where can we fit those people's needs, and how can we get people to understand that that person will get the best assistance that they need, you know, wherever it may be. And that's why I can't give you a definitive answer that there's one way, because there's so many different ways. And in our film, we show you a lot of different things. We also show you what people are being faced with now. You know, a lot of family members are being faced with calling the police all the time because their relative won't get it, go in and get assistance, you know. Or if they get assistance, they can only get it for so long, and then they're back on the street, you know.
Okay. Abner, I'm going to give you a few minutes to close out, and then I'm going to give Mr. Vassal a couple of minutes because I know that he has to go, and then I'm going to close out the show. And I did just want to say one thing. This is Sonya Perdue, CBBN, on Blog Talk Radio, and we want to thank our listeners for joining us. I did want to say one thing simply about the stigmatism, and then I'm going to close out the show. But I do agree with you. Some people just have, you know, problems at work. They're having problems at home, but they don't address them. People are afraid to be labeled as having to speak with a mental health specialist or a professional, whereas they don't always have the answers themselves. They don't know how to answer what's going on with that. And I'll give you one example. I had a friend, and she went to psychologist, we know we don't know. And then she came back and she told, I guess because we were real close friends, told me what the questions that he was asking her and what they were talking about. And I'm like, Dad, that's great. Because even though we're friends and you're talking to me about your problems, I never would have thought to ask you those questions. Mm-hmm. I never would have thought to tell you to do that. You know what I'm saying? Because of the experience. And I thought that was great that they were having that conversation and that type of thing. So it wasn't that she was seriously ill. You know, she just needed a different ear, a different conversation to hear something different instead of the same drumbeat she had been hearing all the time. So she wasn't sick, going nuts or anything. She might have been a little depressed or whatever the case may be, or felt that she needed someone else to talk to. And it worked so perfectly for her, okay? Abana, why don't you take a couple of minutes to, tell us how you'd like to end this, and then Mr. Vessel can, and we're going to close out the show. And I appreciate both of you. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this evening.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to say thank you for having the show. Thank you for inviting me as a guest. I think it is, like Mr. Vessel was saying, and I think that myself and Ms. Daniels said earlier as well, it is something that we don't talk about, and it's important to us happening. It's happening to all of us in more ways than one. One thing that as I listened to Mr. Vessel, and I just kind of went back to my definition of trauma and what it means to be, you know, experience this thing called trauma and people being traumatized. Trauma, in a nutshell, is having insufficient resources to manage whatever stressor is coming at a person. And the things that he described are some examples of resources to meet a particular need. Two, I just want to say from the Bible, if you will, traumatology, what we know as traumatologists is that remembering and telling the truth about terrible events are prerequisites both for restoration of social order and the healing of individual victims. That comes as a direct quote from one of the leading traumatologists in this country, who is a woman of European descent, Judith Herman, from a book called, From Healing from Domestic Terror and Political and Domestic Terror, which is what, as people, we suffer with. One last quick quote from the book Intellectual Warfare from Jacob Carruthers, and this is sort of what guides and directs my work as a practitioner in the mental health, behavioral health field, and which forms the foundation of the program, Racism Non-Anonymous, is this quote that says, when African peoples reunite with African history and culture, solutions to other problems will be possible. For me, it is about culture. It's recognizing the cultural impact, the trauma, the effects of our enslavement and continued political domestic terror and violence that is perpetrated against us for which we have insufficient resources to protect ourselves from. And as a result, people have some pretty wacky behaviors.
Okay.
Thank you, Abena. I appreciate you so much. You know, we're going to do this again. I'm going to try and schedule out and get some more people at our roundtable because I think more things can be said. We need to, everything that you said, those last quotes, all that energy, we need to hear that some more. And I want to thank you. And I will be stopping by your show. I appreciate you.
Okay.
Have a good evening. Thanks. Mr. Vassal. Mr. Vassal,
yeah.
You want to close out? Tell us a little bit. Tell us,
okay.
Is the film out? That's one thing I want to know. I want to know, is the film out?
The film isn't out yet. We just have trailers, and it will come out just as I'm still raising a few more money to finish it up. But I will say something that's really important, and while I'm talking about just America, I'm not only talking about America, but I'm talking about the entire world. We're finding that the situation that we're filming is not only in America, but in other parts of the world. We have to really begin to understand mental illness and the stigma of that, and also our relationship with religious cultures and that kind of thing in terms of, you know, how we feel about people who are often different. But those people who are often different are maybe different because they're just structured differently. And we must address those issues, how to make people become more of who they really are and to remove the stigma, mental illness, and that type of thing. And that will be a more global understanding. But while I'm filming in the USA, I know that Kenya and all places in throughout the China, places like that, are still going to be addressing these issues. With the economy being what it is, the first things to go seem to be treatment for the very mentally ill. But there is hope. There's hope on that we can bring people together to start to talk about it in a different way and to understand that there's no one way to fix it, but there are many ways to fix it.
Mr. Vassal, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And the name of your movie again? It's a documentary, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, Combo 3, Madness in America.
Okay.
And I'm also on Facebook, and I'll have my website back up in a little while, and you'll be able to take a look at that. So
what do you anticipate the length of that film being? How long do you anticipate that documentary being?
Well, it will be 50. It will be 59 minutes an hour. However, the situation was so large, we couldn't put it all in 1 hour. So, you will see a documentary, and then probably later on, you're going to see a series on because there were just so many problems that we found we couldn't put it all in one film. So, the actual film will be 59 minutes an hour. And then we'll probably branch it out to somewhere like PBS or somebody else for a special follow-up to really get in-depth about different issues. Because just one issue itself could be in half an hour and an hour that we addressed, and we ran up against tons of issues. You know?
That had to be very difficult. And you're the associate producer on this project, Mr. Vassal?
No, I'm the original producer.
Okay.
What happened is we teamed up together, so you'll see both our names.
Okay.
We teamed together, but originally it was just my idea, and we teamed up because she had the vision. You know, many times people will have a vision, because I had a vision that this was a huge problem, not only because we were coming from Colorado, there's a huge problem all over the nation. But once you see our film, we'll begin to talk about ways in which we can address the issue. And it's that addressing that you'll find that many things will really be happening with mental illness in this country.
That sounds great. And we hope to keep in touch with me. We hope to have you back because we want to do a part two. I'd like to have some more participants. And I'm not the one that needs to talk. I want to hear the people who have the experience and the knowledge, and because they need to communicate. And I'm sure they do doing the workplace and that type of thing, but continuously, because as Abinel was saying, it's about the language. As Lynn McDaniel, who joined us this evening, can't get my words straight, it's about the language. And we want to speak a language that will help people understand better about what's going on within our community, within the world, within our homes, because some people are in danger even in their homes. Mr. Vessel, I want to thank you for joining us, and I will be in contact with you, okay?
All right. And thank you so much for having me.
It's not a problem. We'll do it again. Have a wonderful evening. This is Sonya Perdue, CBBN, on Blog Talk Radio. I want to make one announcement before we close out this evening. Chicago's Black Business Network is proud to announce that Black Wall Street Chicago has joined our network, and together we anticipate that this will be a purposeful and powerful connection for the members of CBBN. 2010 is going to be a stellar year for our organization. We want you to come out and join us. Ron Carter, who is the chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago, will be hosting a segment of CBBN on Blog Talk Radio on Thursdays entitled Black Wall Street Chicago Speaks. That will be from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. beginning December 10th, and that is this Thursday, and that will continue every Thursday from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., that's Central Standard Time. Also, watch for Black Wall Street Chicago on Channel 7 in Chicago, WLS, at noon on December 19th. Harry Porterfield and Cheryl Burton did a half-an-hour interview with the chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago and the business owners on 75th Street in Chicago. That's the show will air December 19th at noon and will be repeated at 6 p.m. on the same day. Be sure to join us in congratulating Black Wall Street in their success. We look forward to working with and connecting with the Black Wall Street family. We're going to be back next week. That's going to be a member show, and on next Tuesday, where members are going to call in and they're going to have an opportunity to showcase their products and services. We're going to have a part two to this. We want to get some more specialists out. We're going to plan it probably like we have a lot of things coming up in January, so we hope to plan it possibly for the beginning of February so that we can have as many mental specialists as we can so that we can keep it as organized as possible. And because there's just a lot of information to get out. There's just so much information to get out. We want to thank you very much. We'll talk to you next week. This is CBBN on Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Sonya Perdue.
are appreciative of all of our friends, listeners, and members who joined us today. We welcome your thoughts and comments at cbbn@blogtalkradio.com. This is a learning process for all of us. Let's grow and learn together. You are surrounded by resources and tools to take you to the next level in life and business. You don't have to make the journey alone. Join us at chicagosblackbusinessnetwork.com and touch the world. The music in the opening announcement is Bass Vibes. The closing piece is Shades of Spring. Both were written and composed by Kevin McLeod and can be listened to in their entirety on our site. Thank you and have a wonderful night.